Chapter 15. It took no more than a minute of settling back into our old booth at Susie's to feel the magic begin to spark and to realize it was happening all over again. A troublesome case that was getting worse, a pitcher full of high-octane margaritas, my three best friends, all at the top of law enforcement. I was afraid that our murder club was back in business. "Just like old times," Claire smiled, scooting her large frame over to make room for me. "In more ways than you know," I sighed. Then, pouring myself a frothy drink, "Jesus, do I need one of these." "Tough day?" Jill inquired. "No," I shook my head. "Routine. Piece of cake." "That paperwork, it'll drive anyone to drink," Claire shrugged, taking a sip of her margarita. "Cheers. Great to see you, wenches." There was an obvious level of anticipation buzzing through the group. As I took a sip myself, I scanned around. All eyes were focused on me. "Uh-uh," I almost spit into my drink. "I can't get into it. Don't even start." "I told you," Jill croaked with a confirming smile. "Things have changed. Lindsay's management now." "That's not it, Jill. There's a gag order. Mercer's got this thing shut down. Besides, I thought we were here for you." Jill's sharp blue eyes twinkled. "The representative from the district attorney's office is willing to cede the floor to her esteemed colleague from the third floor." "Jesus, guys, I've been on this case for 2 days." "What the hell else is anybody in the city talking about?" said Claire. "You want to hear about my day? I did a full frontal at 10, and then a talk at SFU on the pathology of..."
"We could talk about global warming," Cindy said,
"or this book I'm reading, The Death of Vishnu." "It's not that I don't want to talk about it," I protested. "It's just that it's sealed. Confidential." "Confidential? Like what I turned you on to in Oakland?" Cindy asked. "We have to talk about that," I said. "After." "I'll make you a deal," Jill said. "You share it with us, like always. Then I'll share something. You judge which is juicier. Loser pays the check." It was only a matter of time before I gave in. How could I keep secrets from my girls? It was all over the news, at least part of it, and there weren't three sharper minds anywhere in the hall. An expectant sigh. "This all stays here."
"Of course," Jill and Claire said. "Duh."
I turned to Cindy. "And that means you don't go to press with any of it until I say so." "Do I get the sense I'm always being blackmailed by you?" She shook her head, then acquiesced. "Fine. Deal." Jill filled up my glass. "I knew we'd eventually break you down." I took a sip. "Nah, I decided to tell you when you said tough day." Piece by piece, I took them through the case so far. The decal Bernard Smith had seen on the getaway van, the identical drawing I had found in Oakland, the possibility that Estelle Chipman might have been murdered, Claire's thought that Tasha Catchings may not have been an accidental target after all. "I knew it," Cindy shouted with a triumphant beam. "You've got to find out what that lion image represents," insisted Claire. I nodded. "I'm on it. Big time." Jill, the ADA, inquired, "Anything out there that actually ties these two victims together?" "Nothing so far." "What about motive?" she pressed. "Everyone's reading them as hate crimes, Jill." She nodded cautiously. "And you?" "I'm starting to read them differently. I think we have to consider the possibility that someone's using the hate crime scenario as a smokescreen." There was a long silence at the table. "A racial serial killer," Claire said. Chapter 16. I had shared my news, all of it bad. Everyone ran it over glumly. I nodded to Jill. "Now you." Cindy jumped the gun.
Bennett's not going to run again, is he? In her 8 years in the prosecutor's office, Jill had shot up to be his number two in command. If the old man decided to step down, she was the logical choice to be appointed San Francisco's next DA. Jill laughed and shook her head. He'll be propped up at that oak desk the day he dies. That's the truth. Well, you've got something to tell us, pressed Claire. You're right, she admitted. I do. One by one, Jill met each one of our gazes as if to ratchet up the suspense. Those normally piercing cobalt eyes had never looked so serene. At last, a crooked little smile crept across her face. She let out a sigh, then said, I'm pregnant. We sat there, waiting for her to admit that she was just putting us on. But she didn't. She just kept those sharp eyes blinking right in our faces until 30 seconds must have gone by. You're joking, I stammered. Jill was the most driven woman I knew. You could catch her at her desk almost any night until after 8. Her husband, Steve, ran a venture fund for Bank America. They were fast-track achievers. They mountain biked in Moab, windsurfed on the Columbia River in Oregon. A baby? People do it, she exclaimed at our amazement. I knew it, Claire exclaimed, slapping the table. I just knew it. I saw the look in your eyes. I saw that sheen on your face. I said, something's toasting in that oven. You're talking to an expert, you know. How long? 8 weeks. I'm due at the end of May. Jill's eyes sparkled like a young girl's. Other than our families, you're the first people I've told, of course. Bennett's gonna shit graham crackers, Cindy cackled. He's got 3 of his own, and it's not like I'm trading it in to go off and grow grapes in Petaluma. I'm just having a baby. I found myself smiling. Part of me was so pleased for her I almost wanted to cry. Part of me was even a little jealous. Most of me still couldn't believe it. This kid better know what he's in for, I grinned. He'll be rocked to sleep by tapes of California case law. No way, Jill laughed defiantly. I won't do it. I promise I won't do it. I'm going to be a really good mom. I stood up and leaned across the table to her. This is so great, Jill. For a moment, we just stared at each other, our eyes glistening. I was so damned happy for her. I remembered when I was scared shitless because of a blood disease I had. And Jill had bared her arms to us and showed us her terrible scars. She explained how she had cut herself in high school and college, how the challenge to always go to the top had so deeply ruled her life that she could only take it out on herself. We threw our arms around each other and I squeezed her. Was this something you've been thinking about? Claire asked. We'd been trying for a couple of months, Jill answered, sitting back down. I'm not sure it was any conscious decision other than that the timing seemed right. She looked at Claire. The first time I met you, when Lindsay asked me into your group, and you talked about your kids, it just sort of set off a spark in me. I remember thinking, she runs the ME's office. She's one of the most capable women I know, at the top of her profession. Yet this is what she talks about? When you start out working, Claire explained, you have all this drive and focus. As a woman, you feel you have to prove everything. But when you have kids, it's different, natural. You realize it's no longer about you at all. You realize you no longer have to prove anything. You already have. So, hey, Jill said with glistening eyes, I want a little of that too. I never told this to you guys, she went on. But I was pregnant once before, 5 years ago. She took a sip of water and shook the dark hair off the back of her neck. My career was in overdrive. You remember there was that Lafrade hearing? And Steve had just started running his own fund. It just wasn't the right time for you then, honey, Claire said. That wasn't it, Jill answered quickly. I wanted it. It was just that everything was so intense. I was pulling stints at the office until 10. It seemed like Steve was always away. She paused, a remote cloudiness in her eyes. I had some bleeding. The doctor warned me to cut back. I tried, but everyone was pushing on this case, and I was always alone. One day, I just felt my insides explode. I lost it. In the fourth month. Oh, Jesus, Claire gasped. Oh, Jill. Jill sucked in a breath, and a hushed silence fell over the table. So, how are you feeling? I asked. Ecstatic, she replied. Physically, strong as ever. Then she blinked remotely for a moment and faced us again. Truth is, I'm a total wreck. I reached for her hand. What does your doctor say? He says we'll keep a close watch and keep the sensationalist cases down to a minimum. Run it in low gear. Do you have that gear? I asked. I do now, she sniffed. Wow, Cindy chuckled. Jill suddenly got drag, referring to the dot-com term for anything that could keep you from your job 24/7. In Jill's eyes, I saw a glorious transformation taking place, something I had never seen before. Jill was always successful. She had that beautiful face, that hard-charging drive. Now I could see, at last, that she was happy. Beautiful tears welled up in her eyes. I had seen this woman stand up in court against some of the toughest bastards in the city. I had seen her go after murderers with an undeterred conviction. I had even seen the scars of self-doubt on the insides of her arms. But until that moment, I had never seen Jill cry. Damn it, I smiled. I reached for the check. I guess I pay. Chapter 17. After a few more giddy hugs with Jill, I made my way home to my apartment on Potrero Hill. It was the second floor of a renovated blue Victorian, cozy and bright, with an alcove of wide windows overlooking the bay. Martha, my affectionate border collie, met me at the door. "Hey, sweetie," I said. She wagged up to greet me and threw her paws against my leg. "So how was your day?" I nestled close, smooching her happy face. I went into the bedroom and peeled off my work clothes, pulled up my hair, putting on the oversized giant sweatshirt and flannel pajama pants I lived in when the weather turned cool. I fed Martha, made myself a cup of orange zinger, and sat in the cushioned alcove. I took a sip of tea, Martha perched in my lap. Out in the distance, a grid of blinking airplane lights descending into SFO came into view. I found myself thinking about the unbelievable image of Jill as a mom, her thin, fit figure with a bulging belly. A shower with just us girls. It made me chuckle. I smiled at Martha. Jilly Bean's gonna be a mommy. I had never seen Jill look so complete. It was only a few months ago when my own thoughts had run to how much I would have loved to have a baby. As Jill said, I wanted some of that too. It just wasn't meant to be. Parenting just didn't seem like the natural occupation in my family. My mother had died 11 years before when I was 24 and just entering the police academy. She had been diagnosed with breast cancer, and my last 2 years of college, I helped take care of her, rushing back from class to pick her up at the Emporium where she worked, preparing her meals, watching over my younger sister, Kat. My father, a San Francisco cop, disappeared on us when I was 13. To this day, I didn't know why. I had grown up hearing all the stories, that he handed his paycheck over to the bookies, that he had a secret life away from Mom, that the bastard could charm the pants off anyone, that one day he lost heart and just couldn't put the uniform back on. Last I heard from Kat, he was down in Redondo Beach, doing his own thing, private security. Old-timers down in the Central District still asked me how Marty Boxer was. They still told stories about him. And maybe it was good someone could think about him with a laugh. Marty, who once nabbed three perps with the same set of handcuffs. Marty Boxer, who stopped off to lay a bet with a suspect still in the car. All I could think about was that the bastard let me tend and nurse my mother while she was dying and never came back. I hadn't seen my father for almost 10 years, since the day I became a cop. I'd spotted him in the audience when I graduated from the police academy, but we hadn't spoken. I didn't even miss him anymore. God, it had been ages since I had examined these old scars. Mom had been gone for 11 years. I'd been married, divorced. I had made it into homicide. Now I was running it. Somewhere along the way, I had met the man of my dreams. I was right when I told Mercer the old fire was back. But I was lying when I told myself I had put Chris Raleigh in the past. Chapter 18.
It was always the eyes that got him, naked on his bed. In the stark, cell-like room, he sat staring at the old black-and-white photographs he had looked at 1,000 times. It was always the eyes, that deadened, hopeless resignation. How they posed. Even knowing their lives were about to end, even with the nooses wrapped around their necks. In the loosely bound album, he had 47 photos and postcards arranged in chronological order. He had collected them over the years. The first, an old photograph, dated June 9th, 1901. His father had given him Des Jones, lynched in Great River, Indiana, on the border. Someone had written in faded script, "This was that dance I went to the other night. We sure played afterwards, your son Sam." In the foreground, a crowd in suit coats and bowler hats, and behind them, the limply hanging corpse. He flipped the page. Frank Taylor, Mason, Georgia, 1911. It had cost him $500 to get the photo, but it was worth every penny. From the back of a buggy parked under an oak, the condemned man stared, seconds before his death. On his face, neither resistance nor fear. A small crowd of properly dressed men and women grinned towards the camera as if they were witnessing Lindbergh arriving in Paris, dressed up as if it were a family portrait. Their eyes conveyed that the hanging was something proper and natural. Taylor's, simply that there wasn't a damn thing he could do about it anyway. He got off the bed and dragged his slick, muscular frame to the mirror. He'd always been strong. He had lifted weights for 10 years now. He flinched as he drew blood and mass into his swollen pecs. He massaged a scratch. That old bitch had dug her nails into his chest as he wrapped the coil around the ceiling pipes. And had barely drawn blood, but he looked at the scratch with contempt. He didn't like anything that disturbed the surface of his skin. He posed in front of the mirror, looking at the seething lion goat tattoo across his chest. Soon all the stupid assholes would see that it wasn't about hate. They would read his pattern. The guilty had to be punished. Reputations needed to be restored. He had no particular antipathy for any of them. It wasn't hate. He climbed back on the bed and masturbated to the photo of Missy Preston, whose tiny neck was snapped by a rope in Childers County, Tennessee, in August of 1931. Without even a groan, he ejaculated. The forceful rush made his knees quake. That old lady, she had deserved to die. The choir girl, too. He was pumped up. He massaged a tattoo on his chest. "Pretty soon I will let you free, my pet." He opened his photo scrapbook and flipped to the last blank page, just after Morris Tulo and Sweet Brown in Longbow, Kansas, 1956. He had been saving his spot for the right picture, and now he had it. He took a tube of roll-on glue and dabbed all over the back of the photo, then he pressed it onto the blank page. Here's where it belonged. He remembered her staring up at him, that sad inevitability etched all over her face. The eyes. He admired the new addition. Estelle Chipman, eyes stretched wide, looking at the camera just before he kicked out the chair from under her feet. They always posed.
Chapter 19. First thing the following morning, I called Stu Kirkwood, who ran a hate crimes desk assigned to the police department. I asked him, personally, for any leads on these types of groups that might be operating in the Bay Area. My people had talked to Stu earlier, but I needed action fast. So far, Clapper's CSU team had scoured the area around the church with nothing to show for it, and the only thing we came back with on Aaron Winslow was that no one had a negative thing to say about him. Kirkwood informed me over the phone that a few organized supremacist groups operated out of Northern California, offshoots of the Klan or some crazy neo-Nazi skinheads. He said that maybe the best thing would be to contact the local chapter of the FBI, who kept a much more active eye on them. Gay bashing was more his thing. Bringing in the FBI at this stage didn't fill me with enthusiasm. I asked Kirkwood to give me what he had, and an hour later he came up carrying a plastic bin crammed with red and blue folders. "Background reading," he winked, dropping the bin heavily on my desk. At the sight of the mass of files, my hopes sank. "You got any ideas about this, Stu?" He shrugged sympathetically. "San Francisco's not exactly a hotbed for these groups. Most of what I gave you here seems pretty benign. They seem to spend most of their time hoisting back a few beers and shooting off ammo." I ordered up a salad, figuring I'd spend the next couple of hours at my desk with a bunch of nutcases railing against blacks and Jews. I pulled out a handful of files and opened one at random. "Some sort of militia group, operating up in Greenview, near the Oregon border. The California Patriots. Some summary information supplied by the FBI. Activity type. Militia, 16 to 20 members. Weapons assessment. Minor, small to semi-automatic arms over the counter. On the bottom it had threat, low slash moderate." I skimmed through the file. Some printed materials with logos of crossed guns, detailing everything from population shifts from, quote, the white European majority, unquote, to media cover-ups on government programs to promote test tube fertilization of minorities. I couldn't imagine my killer buying into this claptrap. I didn't see him on the same wavelength at all. Our guy was organized and bold, not some pumped-up backwoods bozo. He had gone to elaborate lengths to hide the murders in the M.O. of a hate crime, and he had signed them. Like most serials, he wanted us to know. And to know, there would be more. I leafed through a few more files. Nothing jumped out at me. I was starting to have the feeling that this was a waste of time. Suddenly, Lorraine burst into my office. "We caught a break, Lieutenant. We found the white van." Chapter 20. I strapped on my Glock and grabbed Cappy and Jacoby on the way out before Lorraine had even finished filling me in. "I want a SWAT team out there," I yelled. 10 minutes later, we all screeched up to a makeshift roadblock on San Jacinto, a quiet residential street. A radio car on routine patrol had spotted a Dodge Caravan parked outside a house in Tony Forest Hills. What made him sure that this was the car we were looking for was the decal of a two-headed lion on the rear bumper. Vasquez, the young patrolman who had called in the van, pointed toward a tree-shaded Tudor halfway down the block, the white minivan parked at the end of the driveway. It seemed crazy. This was an affluent neighborhood, not a likely haven for criminals or murderers. But there it was, our white van, and Bernard Smith's Mufasa. Moments later, an unmarked SWAT vehicle, rigged to look like a cable TV repair truck, pulled onto the street. The team was headed by Lieutenant Skip Arbuchow. I didn't know what the situation entailed, whether we would have a siege or possibly have to break our way in. "Cappy, Jacoby, and I will go in first," I said. This was a homicide operation, and I wasn't letting anyone else take the risk. I had Arbuchow deploy his men, two around the back, three manning the front, and one with a sledge with us in case we had to bust in. We strapped on protective vests and donned black nylon jackets identifying us as police. I clicked my 9mm off safety. There wasn't much time to get nervous. The SWAT truck started down the street, three black-vested snipers hugging its opposite side. Cappy, Jacoby, and I followed the truck as cover until it pulled to a stop in front of a mailbox marked 610. Vasquez was right. The van was a match. My heart was racing now. I had been in many forced entries before, but none with more at stake. We cautiously wove our way to the front of the house. There were lights on inside, some noise from a TV. At my nod, Cappy pounded the door with his gun. San Francisco police! Jacoby and I crouched with our guns ready. No one answered. After a few tense seconds, I signaled Arbuchow for a ram. Suddenly, the front door cracked open. Freeze! Cappy boomed, swinging his gun into a shooting position. San Francisco police! A wide-eyed woman in powder-blue exercise clothes stood frozen in the door. Oh my God! She screeched, eyes fastened on our weapons. Cappy yanked her out the front door as Arbuchow's SWAT team rushed the house. He barked, Is anyone else at home? Just my daughter, the frightened woman shrieked. She's two! The black-vested SWAT team barged past her into the house as if they were searching for Elian Gonzalez. Is that your van? Jacoby barked. The woman's eyes darted toward the street. What is this about? Is that your van? Jacoby's voice boomed again. No, she said, trembling. No! Do you know who it belongs to? She looked again, terrified, and shook her head. I've never seen it before in my life. It was all wrong. I could see that. The neighborhood, the plastic kid slide on the lawn, the spooked mom in the workout clothes. A disappointed sigh was expelled from my chest. The van had been dumped here. All of a sudden, a green Audi knifed its way up to the curb, followed by two police cars. The Audi must have gone right through our roadblock. A well-dressed man in a suit and tortoiseshell glasses jumped out and ran toward the house. Kathy, what the hell's going on? Steve! The woman hugged him with a sigh of relief. This is my husband. I called him when I saw all the police outside our house. The man looked around at the eight cop cars, SWAT backup, and the SFPD inspectors standing around with weapons drawn. What are you doing at my house? This is insane. This is nuts. We believe that van was the vehicle used in the commission of a homicide, I said. We have every right to be here.
A homicide?
Two of Arbuchow's men emerged from the house, indicating that there wasn't anyone else inside. Across the street, people were starting to file outdoors. That van's been our number one priority for 2 days. I'm sorry to have upset you. There was no way to be sure. The husband's indignation rose. His face and neck were beet red. You're thinking we had something to do with this? With a homicide? I figured I had upset their lives enough. The LaSalle Heights shooting. Have you people lost your minds? You suspected us in the strafing of a church? His jaw dropped, and he fixed on me incredulously. Do you idiots have any idea what I do? My eyes fell on his pinstriped gray suit, his blue button-down collar shirt. I had the humiliating feeling I had just been made a fool of. I'm chief counsel for the Northern California chapter of the Anti-Defamation League. Chapter 21. We had been made fools of by the killer. No one on the block knew anything about or had any connection to the stolen van. It had been dumped there, purposely, to show us up. Even as Clapper's CSU went over it inch by inch, I knew it wouldn't yield shit. I studied the decal, and I was sure it was the same thing I had seen in Oakland. One head was a lion's, one seemed to be a goat's. The tail suggested a reptile. But what the hell did it mean? One thing we learned, Jacoby smirked. The SOB's got a sense of humor. I'm glad you're a fan, I said. Back at the hall, I said to Lorraine, I want to know where that van came from. I want to know who it belonged to, who had access to it, every contact the owner had a month prior to its theft. I was fuming mad. We had a vicious killer out there, but not a single clue as to what made him tick. Was it a hate crime or a killing spree? An organized group or a lone wolf? We knew the guy was fairly intelligent. His strikes had been well planned, and if irony was part of his M.O., dumping the getaway car where he had was a real beaut. Karen buzzed in, informing me that Ron Vandervellen was on the line. The Oakland cop came on chuckling.
Word is you managed to subdue a dangerous threat to our society masquerading as a legal watchdog in the Anti-Defamation League.
I guess that makes our investigations about equal, Ron, I retorted.
Relax, Lindsay. I didn't call to rub it in, he said, shifting his tone. Actually, I thought I would make your day.
I won't argue, Ron. I could use anything about now. What do you have for us?
You knew Estelle Chipman was a widow, right?
I think you mentioned that.
Well, we were doing some standard background on her. We found a son in Chicago. He's coming to claim the body. Given what's been going on, I thought what he told us was too coincidental to ignore.
What, Ron?
Her husband died 5 years ago. Heart attack. Want to guess what the dude did for a living?
I had the rising feeling Vandervellen was about to blow this thing wide open.
Estelle Chipman's husband was a San Francisco cop.
Chapter 22. Cindy Thomas parked her Mazda across from the LaSalle Heights Church and let out a long sigh. The church's white clapboard front had been defaced by a pattern of ugly chinks and bullet holes. A gaping hole where the beautiful stained glass window had been was sealed with a black canvas tarp. She remembered seeing it the day the window was first unveiled, on her old beat at the paper. The mayor, some local dignitaries, Aaron Winslow, all had made speeches about how the beautiful scene had been paid for through community work. A symbol. She remembered interviewing Winslow and being impressed with his passion, and also his unexpected humbleness. Cindy ducked under the yellow police tape and stepped closer to the bullet-ridden wall. On her job at the Chronicle, she'd been assigned to other stories where people had died. But this was the first one where she felt the human race had died a little, too. She was startled by a voice. You can stare for as long as you want, but it doesn't get any prettier. Cindy spun and found herself facing a man with a smooth and very handsome face. Kind eyes. She knew him. She nodded. I was here when the window was unveiled. It carried a lot of hope. Still does, Winslow said. We didn't lose our hope. Don't worry about that. She smiled, staring into his deep brown eyes. I'm Aaron Winslow, he said, shifting a stack of children's textbooks to extend his hand. Cindy Thomas, she replied. His grip was warm and gentle. Don't tell me they've put our church as one of the scenic sites on the 49-mile drive. Winslow started to walk toward the rear of the church, and she followed along. I'm not a tourist, Cindy said. I just wanted to see this. Listen. She swallowed. I'd like to pretend I just came by to pay my respects, which I did. But I'm also with the Chronicle, on the crime desk. A reporter? Winslow exhaled. It makes sense now. For years, everything that really goes on here, tutoring, literacy training, a nationally recognized choir, doesn't crank up a story. But one madman acts, and now Nightline wants to do a town meeting. What do you want to know, Miss Thomas? What does the Chronicle want? His words had stung her a little, but she kind of liked that. He was right. Actually, I did a story here once before, when that window was unveiled. It was a special day. He stopped working. He focused his eyes on her, then smiled. It was a special day. And actually, Ms. Thomas, I knew who you were when I walked up. I remember you.
You interviewed me back then. Someone called Winslow's name from inside the church, and a woman came out. She reminded him that he had an 11 o'clock meeting. So, have you seen all you came to see, Ms. Thomas? Should we expect you back in another couple of years? No. I want to know how you deal with this. This violence in the face of all you've done. How the neighborhood feels about it. Winslow let himself smile. Let me clue you in on something. I don't deal in innocence. I've spent too much time in the real world. She remembered that Aaron Winslow wasn't someone whose faith had been formed through a life of detachment. He'd come up from the streets. He'd been an army chaplain. Only days before, he'd put himself in the line of fire and possibly saved lives. You came here to see how this neighborhood is responding to the attack? Come see for yourself. Tasha Catchings is being memorialized tomorrow. Chapter 23. Vandervellen's stunning disclosure drummed in my head for the rest of the day. Both murder victims had been related to a San Francisco cop. It could add up to nothing. They could be two random and unrelated victims, people in different cities, separated by 60 years. Or it could mean everything. I picked up the phone and called Claire. I need a big favor, I said. Just how big? I could feel her grin. I need you to take a look at the autopsy of that woman who was hung in Oakland. I can do that. Send it over. I'll take a look. This is where it gets huge, Claire. It's still at the Oakland ME's office. It hasn't been released. I waited expectantly as she sighed. You must be kidding, Lindsay. You want me to stick my nose into an investigation that's still in progress? Listen, Claire, I know this isn't exactly procedure, but they've made some pretty important assumptions that could determine this case. Want to tell me what type of assumptions I'd be stepping all over a respected ME's toes to review? Claire, these cases are related. There's a pattern here. Estelle Chipman was married to a cop. Tasha Catching's uncle was a cop, too. My whole investigation hinges on whether we're dealing with one killer. Oakland believes there's a black man involved, Claire. A black man, she gasped. Why would a black want to do these things? I don't know. But there's starting to be a lot of circumstantial evidence linking both crimes. I have to know. She hesitated. Precisely what the hell would I be looking for? I told her about the skin specimens they had found under the victim's nails and their ME's conclusion. Titleman's a good man, Claire responded. I'd trust his findings like I would my own. I know, Claire, but he's not you. Please, this is important. I want you to know, she shot back, that if Art Titleman asked to poke his nose into one of my preliminary investigations, I'd have his parking ticket stamped and politely tell him to go back to his side of the bay. I wouldn't do this for anyone else, Lindsay. I know that, Claire, I said with a grateful tone. Why do you think I've been working this friendship all these years? Chapter 24. Late that afternoon, I sat at my desk as one by one my staff called it quits for the day. I couldn't leave with them. My mind tried over and over to put together the parts. Everything I had was based on assumptions. Was the killer black or white? Was Claire right? That Tasha Catchings was intentionally killed? But the lion symbol had definitely been there. Link the victims, my instinct said. There's a connection, but what the hell is it? I glanced at my watch and placed a call to Simone Clark in personnel, catching her just as she was preparing to leave. Simone, I need you to pull a file for me tomorrow. Sure, whose do you need? A cop who retired maybe 8-10 years ago. His name was Edward Chipman. That's a while back. It would be out on the docks. The department outsourced its old records to a document storage company. Early afternoon, okay?
Sure, Simone. Best you can do. I was still bristling with nervous energy. I took out another stack of Kirkwood's hate files and plopped them on my desk. I opened one at random. Americans for Constitutional Action, Plows and Fifes. Another hayseed militia group. All these assholes, they seemed like a bunch of right-wing jerk-offs. Was I wasting my time? Nothing jumped out. Nothing gave me any hope that this was the right track. Go home, Lindsay, a voice urged. Tomorrow, new leads might develop. There's the van, Chipman's file. Call it a night. Take Martha for a run. Go home. I stacked the files, about to give in, when the one on the top caught my eye. The Templars, a Hell's Angels offshoot out of Vallejo. The original Templars were Christian knights from the Crusades. Immediately, I noticed the FBI's assessment of threat. Their rating was high. I took the file off the pile and leafed further in. There was an FBI report outlining a series of unsolved felonies the Templars had been suspected of involvement in, bank robberies, hits for hire against Latino and black gangs. I leafed on, case files, prison records, surveillance photos of the group. Suddenly, the breath emptied out of my lungs. My eyes fixed on a surveillance shot. A bunch of heavy, muscled, tattoo-covered bikers huddled outside a Vallejo bar they used as a headquarters. One of them hunched over his bike back to the camera. He had a shaved head, a bandana, and a sleeveless denim jacket over massive arms. It was the embroidery on the back of the denim jacket that caught my eye. I was staring at a two-headed lion with the tail of a snake. Chapter 25.
South of Market, in a rundown warehouse section of the city, a man in a green windbreaker ducked along the shadowy curb. The killer. This time of night, in this decrepit neighborhood, no one was around. Only a couple of scum bums huddled over a blazing trash can. Abandoned warehouses, daytime businesses with shorted out electrical signs. Checks cash today. Metalworks. Earl King, city's most trusted bail bondsman. His eyes drifted across the street toward 7th to the dilapidated shell of an abandoned residential hotel, 303. He had carefully staked the place out over the past 3 weeks. Half the apartments were vacant, the other half the nightly resting place for homeless bums with nowhere else to go. Spitting into the trash-littered streets, he threw a black Adidas sports bag over his shoulder and headed around the block onto 6th and Townsend. He crossed the dingy street towards a boarded-up warehouse marked only by a scratched-out sign, Aguelos, Comidas Español. Making sure he was alone, the killer pushed in the paint-chipped metal door. Then he ducked inside. His heart was starting to pump pretty good now. He was addicted to the feeling, actually. A foul odor met him in the lobby, a fire trap that was littered with old newspapers and oily corrugated boxes. He hit the stairs, hoping not to run into any of the homeless scum camped out in the halls. He climbed all the way to 5, where he quickly made his way to the end of the hall. He pushed through a grating and stepped out onto the fire escape. From there, it was only a quick flight up to the roof. Up here, the desolate streets gave way to the luminous aura of the city skyline. His position was in the shadow of the Bay Bridge, which loomed over him like a hulking ship. He rested the black sports bag on an air conditioning vent, unzipped it, and carefully removed the parts of a customized PSG-1 sniper rifle. At the church, I needed maximum saturation. Here I only get one shot. As traffic rumbled over him on the Bay Bridge freeway, he screwed the long barrel of the rifle to the shaft and locked it in place. Handling guns was like handling a fork and knife to him. He could do this in his sleep. He fastened on the infrared sight. He squinted through it, amber-colored shapes coming into focus. He was so much smarter than them. While they were looking for white vans and silly-ass symbols, he was here, about to blow the lid wide open. Tonight, they would finally begin to understand. His heart slowed as he aimed across the street at the rear of the transient hotel, marked 303. On the fourth floor, a dimly lit apartment shone through the window. This was it. The moment of truth. He calmed his breath to a whisper and licked his dry lips. He aimed at a picture in his mind he had held for so long. He feathered the sight. Then, when it was just right, he squeezed. Click. This time he wouldn't even have to sign it. They'd know from the shot, from the target. Tomorrow, every person in San Francisco would know his name. Chimera.
Part 2. Justice Will Be Served. Chapter 26. I knocked on Stu Kirkwood's glass office door, interrupting his morning coffee and bagel. I tossed the surveillance shot of the biker wearing the lion with the tail of a snake in front of him. I need to know what this is. I need it ASAP, Stu. I followed the shot up with two other versions of the same image, the decal on the rear of the white van, and a Polaroid of the basement wall where Estelle Chipman had been killed. Lion, goat, tail of a snake, or lizard. Kirkwood stiffened. I don't have any idea, he looked up and said. This is our killer, Stu. So how do we find him? I thought this was your specialty. I told you, gay bashing's more my bag. We could email the pictures to Quantico. Okay, I nodded. How long will it take? Kirkwood straightened up. I know a chief researcher down there I took a seminar with. Let me put in the call. Do it quick, Stu. Then finish your bagel. And let me know as soon as you get something back, the minute you hear something. Upstairs, I nudged Jacoby and Cappy into my office. I slid Kirkwood's Templar file and a copy of the biker photo across my desk. You recognize the artist, guys? Cappy studied the photo and glanced up. You're thinking that these dust mites have something to do with the case? I want to know where these guys are, I said, and I want you to be careful. This crew's been implicated in stuff that makes LaSalle Heights seem like a paintball outing. Weapons traffic, aggravated violence, murder for hire. According to the file, they operate out of a bar over in Vallejo called the Blue Parrot. I don't want you busting in there like you're razzing a pimp down on Geary. And remember, it's not our jurisdiction. We hear you, Lou, Cappy said. No thumping, just a little R&R. It'll be nice to spend the day out of town. He picked up the file and tapped Jacoby on the shoulder. Your club's in the trunk? Guys, careful, I reminded them. Our killer's a shooter. After they left, I leafed through a handful of messages and opened the Morning Chronicle on my desk. There was a headline with Cindy's attribution reading, Police widened shooting probe. Oakland woman's death thought to be brought in. Quoting, sources close to the investigation and unnamed police contacts, she outlined the possibility that we had widened our investigation, citing the murder in Oakland. I had given her the green light to go that far. I speed-dialed Cindy. This is source close to the investigation calling, I said. No way! You're unnamed contact. Source close to the investigation is Jacoby. Oh, shit, I chuckled. I'm glad you have a sense of humor. Listen, I have something important I need to show you. Are you going to Tasha Catching's funeral? I looked at my watch. It was scheduled in less than an hour. Yeah, I'll be there. Look for me, Cindy said. Chapter 27. A biting drizzle was coming down as I arrived at the LaSalle Heights Church. Hundreds of black-clad mourners were jammed into the bullet-scarred church. A canvas was draped over the gaping hole where the stained-glass window had been. It flapped like a somber flag whipped by the breeze. Mayor Fernandez was there, along with other important faces I recognized from city government. Vernon Jones, the activist, was stationed an arm's length from the family. Chief Mercer was there, too. This little girl was getting the biggest funeral the city had seen in years. It made her death seem even sadder. Standing in the rear of the chapel in a short black suit, I spotted Cindy. We both nodded as we caught each other's eye. I took a seat near Mercer among a delegation from the department.
Soon the famous LaSalle Heights Choir began a haunting rendition of I'll Fly Away. There is nothing more stirring than uplifting hymns resonating through a filled church. I have my own private credo, and it starts not far from what I've seen on the streets. Nothing in life ever breaks down simply into good or bad, judgment or redemption. But when the swell of voices lifted up the church, it didn't seem wrong to privately ask for mercy to shine down on this innocent soul. After the choir finished, Aaron Winslow stepped up to a microphone. He looked very elegant in a black suit. He spoke about Tasha Catchings as someone who had known her most of her life could. Her little girl's giggle, the poise she showed being the youngest in the choir, how she wanted to be a diva or an architect who would rebuild this neighborhood, how now only the angels would get to hear her beautiful voice. He didn't speak like some gentle minister exhorting people to turn the other cheek. He kept it hopeful, very emotional, but real. I couldn't watch him without thinking that this handsome man had been on the battlefields of Desert Storm, and that only the other day he had put his life at risk to protect his children. He said, his voice soft but powerful, that he could not forgive, and he could not help but judge. Only saints don't judge, he said, and believe me, I'm no saint. I'm like all of you, just someone who has grown tired of having to make peace with injustice. He looked toward Chief Mercer. Find the killer. Let judgment be in the courts. This isn't about politics or faith or even race. It is about the right to be free from hate. I am convinced that the world doesn't break in the face of its worst possible deed. The world mends itself. People rose up, and they clapped and they cried. I stood with them. My eyes were wet. Aaron Winslow brought such dignity to these proceedings. It was over within an hour. No blazing sermons, only a smattering of amens. But a sadness none of us would ever forget. Tasha's mother looked so strong as she followed the casket out, her young daughter being carried to her final rest. I filed out to a chorus of Will the Circle Be Unbroken, feeling numb and broken. Chapter 28. Outside, I waited for Cindy, and I watched Aaron Winslow mingle among mourners and weeping schoolmates. There was something about him I liked. He seemed genuine to me, and he definitely had a passion for his work and these people. Now there's a man I could share a foxhole with, said Cindy, coming up to me. And just how do you mean that? I asked. I'm not sure. All I can say is I came out here yesterday to talk with him, and I left with the hairs on my arms standing up at attention. I felt like I was interviewing Denzel Washington or maybe the new guy on NYPD Blue. You know, ministers aren't the same as priests, I said. Meaning what? Meaning it's okay to go into foxholes with them, just to get out of the line of fire, of course. Of course, she nodded. Then she mimicked an exploding mortar shot. Pow! He is impressive. His speech made me cry. Is that what you meant to show me? No, she said with a sigh, coming back to the matter at hand. She dug in her black shoulder bag and pulled out a folded piece of paper. I know you told me to butt out. I guess I'd just gotten used to covering your ass. Right, I said. So what do you have for me? We're a team, right? As I unfolded the paper, to my shock, I found myself staring at the same lion, goat, and snake rendering I had just given Kirkwood to identify. Professional restraint couldn't keep my eyes from opening wide. Where did you get this? You know what you're looking at, Lindsay? My guess is that this is not Tycho's new toy craze. She didn't laugh. What it is a hate group symbol, a white supremacist thing. A colleague at the paper did research on these groups. I couldn't help looking into it after our meeting the other night. This is used by a small elite group, That's why it was hard to find out about. I stared at the image that I had seen over and over again since Tasha Catchings had been killed. This thing has a name, doesn't it? It's called a chimera, Lindsay. It's from Greek mythology. According to my source, the lion represents courage, the body of the goat stubbornness and will, and the serpent's tail stealth and cunning. It means that whatever you do to crush it, it will always prevail. I stared at the symbol, the chimera, the bile roiling in my gut. Not this time. I haven't run with it, Cindy said, but it's out there. Everybody thinks these murders are connected. This symbol is the key, right? Let me give you a second definition I found. A grotesque product of the imagination. That fits, right? I found myself nodding. Back to square one. Hate groups. Maybe even the Templars. Once Mercer found out, we'd be busting the doors down on every hate group we could find. But how the hell could the killer be black? It didn't make sense to me. You're not mad at me, are you? Cindy asked. I shook my head. Of course I'm not mad. So that source of yours, did he tell you just how they killed this chimera back then? He said they called in some big hero who rode a winged horse and cut off its head. Nice to have dudes or dudesses like that around in a pinch, huh? She looked at me seriously. You have a winged horse, Lindsay? No, I shook my head again. I've got a border collie. Chapter 29. Claire met me in the lobby of the hall just as I returned with a salad. Where are you heading? I asked. She held my eye coyly, dressed in an attractive purple coat dress, a Tumi leather briefcase slung over her shoulder. Actually, I was coming to see you. Claire had a look on her face that I had learned to recognize. You wouldn't call it smugness or self-importance. Claire didn't run that way. It was more of a twinkle that read, I found something, or more like, sometimes I even amaze myself. You had lunch? I asked. She snickered. Lunch? Who has time for lunch? Since 10:30, I've been under a microscope across the bay covering for you. She peeked into my bag and caught a glimpse of my curried chicken salad. That looks tempting. I pulled it back. That depends on what you came up with. She pushed me into the elevator. I had to promise Titelman parterre box seats to the symphony to calm him down, Claire said as we got to my office. You can consider it Edmund's treat. Edmund was her husband who, for the past 6 years, had played kettle drums for the San Francisco Symphony. I'll send him a note, I said as we sat around my desk. Maybe I can get him Giants tickets. I set out my lunch. Do you mind? She asked, dangling a plastic fork over the salad. Saving your ass is tiring work. I pulled the container away. Like I said, depends on what you have. Without hesitating, Claire speared a piece of chicken. Didn't make sense, did it? Why a black man would be acting out hate crimes against his own race. All right, I said, pushing the container her way. What did you find out? She nodded. Mostly it was pretty much like you told me. None of the normal abrasions or lacerations you would connect with a forced submission. But then there were those unusual dermal specimens from under the subject's nails. So we scoped it. They did reveal a hyperpigmented skin type. As the report said, normally consistent with a non-Caucasian. Samples are out being histopathologied as we speak. So what are you saying? I pressed. The person who killed that woman was black? Claire leaned over, lifting the last piece of chicken out from under my fork. At first blush, I could see how someone might feel that way. If not African-American, then a dark Latino or Asian. Titelman was inclined to agree, until I asked him to perform one last test. I ever tell you, she mooned her wide brown eyes, I did my residency at Moffitt. In dermatopathology? No, Claire. I found myself shaking my head and smiling. She was so good at what she did. She shrugged. No, huh? I don't know how we overlooked that.
Anyway, basically, what a lab is going to be looking for is whether that hyperpigmentation is intracellular, as in melanocytes, which are the dark pigmented cells that are much more concentrated in non-Caucasians, or the intercellular, in the tissue, more on the surface of the skin. English, Claire. Is the subject white or black? Melanocytes, she continued, as if I hadn't asked, are the dark skin cells concentrated in people of color. She pushed up her sleeve. You are looking at melanocyte central here. Trouble is, the sampling found under the Chipman lady's nails didn't have a one. All that pigment was intercellular, surface coloration. On top of that, it was a bluish hue, atypical for naturally occurring melanin. Any self-respecting dermatopathologist would have caught that. Caught what, Claire? I asked, fixing on her smug grin. Caught that it wasn't a black man who did that terrible thing, she said emphatically, but a white man with some topical pigmentation. Ink, Lindsay. What that poor woman dug her nails into was the killer's tattoo. Chapter 30. After Claire left, I was buoyed by her discovery. This was good stuff. Karen knocked and handed me a manila folder. From Simone Clark? It was the file from personnel I had requested, Edward R. Chipman. I slid the file out of the envelope and began to read. Chipman had been a career street patrolman out of Central who retired in 1994 with the rank of sergeant. He had twice received a captain's commendation for bravery on the job. I stopped at his photo. A narrow, chiseled face with one of those bushy afros popular in the 60s. It was probably taken the day he joined the force. I looked through the rest of the contents. What would make someone want to kill this man's widow? There wasn't a single censure on his record, for excessive force or anything else. In his 30-year career, the officer never fired his gun. He was part of the police outreach unit in the Potrero Hill Projects and a member of the minority action group called the Officers for Justice, which lobbied for and promoted the interests of black officers. Chipman, like most cops, had one of those proud, uneventful careers, never in trouble, never under review, never in the public's eye. Nothing in there drew the slightest connection to Tasha Catchings or to her uncle, Kevin Smith. Had I read more into the whole thing than was there? Was this even a serial thing? My antennae were crackling. I know there's something. Come on, Lindsay. Suddenly, I was hammered back to reality by Lorraine Stafford knocking at my door. You got a minute, Lieutenant? I asked her in. The stolen vehicle, she informed me, belonged to a Ronald Stasek. He taught anthropology at a community college down in Mountain View. Apparently, the van was stolen from the parking lot outside where he works. The reason it was late being reported missing was that he went to Seattle for a night, job interview. Who knew he was going to be away? She flipped through her notes. His wife, the college administrator. He teaches two classes at the college and tutors students from other schools in the area. Any of these students show an interest in his van or in where he parked? She snickered. He said half these kids come to class in BMWs and Saabs. Why would they be interested in a 6-year-old van? What about that sticker on the back? I had no idea if Stasek had anything to do with these killings, but his van did have the same symbol on it that had turned up in the Oakland basement. Lorraine shrugged, said he never saw it before. I said I'd check his story and asked if he'd take a lie detector on that. He told me to go right ahead. You better check if any of his friends or his students have any weird political leanings. Lorraine nodded. I will, but this guy's totally legit, Lindsay. He acted like he was jerked out of his skin. As the afternoon wound down, I had the shaky feeling that we were nowhere on this case. I was sure it was a serial,
but maybe our best chance was this guy with the chimera embroidered on his jacket. My phone rang, startling me. It was Jacoby.
Bad information, LT. We've been outside this damn blue parrot place all day. Nothing. So we managed to find out from the bartender the dudes you're looking for are history. They split 5-6 months ago. Toughest guy we've seen was some weightlifter wearing a Rock Rules t-shirt.
What do you mean by split, Warren?
Vamoose. Moved on. Somewhere south. According to the dude, one or two guys used to hang around with them, still come in from time to time. Some big red-headed dude. But basically, they hit the road. Permanentemente.
Keep on it. Find me the red-headed dude. Now that the van led nowhere, and I had no connection between the victims, that lion and snake symbol was all we had.
Keep on it, Jacoby whined. How long? We could be here for days.
I'll send out a change of underwear, I said, and hung up. For a while, I just sat there, rocking back in my chair with a mounting feeling of dread. It had been 3 days since Tasha Catchings was killed, and 3 days before that, Estelle Chipman. I had nothing. No significant clues. Only what the killer had left us. This damned chimera. And the knowledge. Serials kill. Serials don't stop until you catch them. Chapter 31.
Patrolman Sergeant Art Davidson responded to the 160 the minute he heard the call. Disturbance, domestic violence, 3037 Street upstairs. Available units respond. He and his partner Gil Herrera were only 4 blocks away on Bryant. It was almost 8. Their shift was over in 10 minutes. You want to take it, Gil? Said Davidson, glancing at his watch. His partner shrugged. Your call, Artie. You're the one with the wild party to go to. Some wild party. It was his 7-year-old's birthday, Audra. He had called in on break, and Carol said that if he got home by 9:30, she'd keep her up for him so that he could give her the Britney Spears makeup mirror he had picked out. Davidson had 5 kids. They were his life. What the hell, Davidson shrugged. It's what we get paid the big bucks for, right? They hit the siren, and in less than a minute, Mobile 2-4 pulled up in front of the dismal and dilapidated entrance of 303 7th. The tilted sign on the defunct Driscoll Hotel hanging over the front door. People still camping out in this dump, Herrera sighed. Who the hell would live here? The two cops grabbed their nightsticks and a large flashlight and stepped up to the front door. Davidson pulled it open. Inside, the place smelled of feces, urine, probably rats. Hey, anybody here? Davidson called out. Police! Suddenly, from above, they heard the sound of shouting, some kind of argument. On it, Herrera said, bounding up the first flight. Davidson followed. On the second floor, Gil Herrera went down the hall, banging his flashlight on the door. Police! Police! In the stairwell, Davidson suddenly heard the sounds again, loud, frantic voices. A crash, as if something had broken. The noise came from over his head. He headed up 2 flights of stairs on his own. The noise grew even louder. He stopped in front of a shut door, apartment 42. Bitch! Someone yelled. The sound of a plate shattering. A woman seemed to beg. Stop him! He's gonna kill me! Stop him, please! Someone help me, please! Police! Art Davidson responded and drew his gun. He yelled, Herrera! Up here, now! He threw all his weight against the door. It opened. The inside was dimly lit, but from an interior room, more light. And the arguing voices, closer, screaming. Art Davidson clicked his gun off safety. Then he barged through the open door into the room. To his amazement, no one was there. There was a dim yellow light angled from an exposed bulb, a metal chair with a large boombox on it, loud voices coming from the speakers. The words were the same ones he'd heard earlier. Stop him! He's gonna kill me! What the hell? Davidson squinted in disbelief. He walked over to the stereo, knelt down, and turned off the power. The loud, blaring argument came to a halt. What the fuck? Davidson muttered. Somebody playing games? He looked around. The pitiful room looked as if it hadn't been occupied in a while. His eyes were drawn to the window, then beyond it, across the alley, to a facing building. He thought he saw something. What was it? Ping! His eye caught the tiniest pinprick of a yellow spark, so quick it was like the snap of a finger. the blink of a firefly on a dark night. Then the window splintered and a blunt force slammed into Art Davidson's right eye. He was dead before he hit the floor.
Chapter 32. I had just about gotten home when the distress call crackled in. Available units proceed to 303 7th near Townsend. 106. Officer in trouble. I pulled my Explorer to the curb, listened to the call, EMSs to the scene, the district captain called in. The quick, urgent exchanges convinced me the situation was critical. The hairs on my arms were standing up. It was an ambush, a long-distance shot. Like LaSalle Heights, I threw my car in gear and executed a quick U-turn down Potrero, slamming into 3rd Street and heading for downtown. When I pulled up 4 blocks from Townsend and 7th, bedlam reigned. Barricades of blue and whites, flashing lights, uniforms everywhere, radios crackling in the night. I drove ahead, holding my police ID out the window, until I couldn't go any farther. Then I left my car and ran toward the center of the commotion. I grabbed the first patrolman I could find. "Who is it? Do you know?" "Patrol cop," he said. "Out of Central. Davidson." "Oh, shit." My heart sank. I felt nauseous. I knew Art Davidson. We had gone through the academy at the same time. He was a good cop, a good guy. Did it mean anything that I knew him? Then a second wave of fear and nausea. Art Davidson was black. I pushed my way through the crowd toward a run-down tenement where a ring of EMS trucks were parked. I ran into Chief of Detectives Sam Ryan coming out of the building, holding a radio to his ear. I pulled him aside. "Sam, I heard it was Art Davidson. Any chance?" Ryan shook his head. "Chance? He was lured here, Lindsay. Rifle shot to the head. Single shot, we think. He's already been pronounced." I stood to the side, a whirring wail growing louder and louder inside my skull, as if some private, unknowable fear had revealed itself only to me. I was sure it was him. Chimera. Murder number 3. He only needed one shot this time. I brandished my badge to the uniformed cops at the entrance and hurried into the run-down building. Some EMS techs were coming down the stairs. I kept going past them. My legs felt heavy, and I could hardly breathe. On the 3rd-floor landing, a uniformed cop barreled past me, shouting, "Coming down! Everybody get out of the way!" A couple of medical techs appeared, and 2 more cops carrying a gurney. I couldn't turn my head away. "Hold it here," I said. It was Davidson, his eyes still and open, a crimson, dime-sized peephole above his right eye. Every nerve in my body seemed to go slack. I remembered that he had children. Did these murders have something to do with kids? "Oh, Jesus, Art," I whispered. I forced myself to study his body, the bullet wound. I finally touched the side of his forehead. "You can take him down now," I said. "Fuck." I made my way to the next floor, somehow. A crowd of angry plainclothesmen was gathered outside an open apartment. I saw Pete Starcher, an ex-homicide detective who worked with IAB, coming out. I went up to him. "Pete, what the hell happened?" Starcher had always had an edge for me. He was one of those cynical old-timers. "You got business here, Lieutenant?" I knew Art Davidson. We went through school together. I didn't want to give him any inkling of why I was here. Starcher sniffed, but he filled me in. The 2 patrolmen were responding to a 911 in the building. There was only this tape recorder there. It was all set up, orchestrated. "He was suckered. Some son of a bitch wanted to kill a cop." My body grew numb. I was sure it was him. "I'm going to look around." Inside, it was just like Starcher had said. Spooky, weird, unreal. The living room was empty. Walls stripped of paint and cracks in the plaster. As I wandered into the adjoining room, I froze. There was a pool of blood soaked into the floor.
Blood had splattered on the wall where the bullet had probably lodged. Poor Davidson. A portable tape deck sat on a folding chair in the center of the room. I looked to the window, a hanging pane of splintered glass. Suddenly, everything was clear to me. There was a cold spot at the center of my chest. I went to the open window, leaned out, looked across the street. There was no sign of Chimera or anybody, but I knew. I knew because he had told me. The shot? The victim? He wanted us to know it was him.